colleagues announced an introduction. So indeed, the talk is going to be about computing the Higgs boson cross-section as precisely as we can. And well, okay. For this audience, of course, I don't need to motivate it too much. We have had many, many talks already. So basically, we want to establish the mechanism behind electric symmetry breaking at the LHC. So we want to study the Higgs boson and its properties. And you know these are the main production mechanisms. I'm going to be very fast in a couple of slides because you all know this. And the dominant production mechanism, as you know, is gluon fusion. And that is also what I'm going to talk about. So I'm only going to talk about gluon fusion. I'm not at all about the other production mechanisms. So we had a talk last week by Ilam about combination. And basically, I think one of the main messages, well, already before, was that the world looks pretty much standard model-like. So all the mu values, in particular here, the mu value for the gluon fusion cross-section, this talk is about, is pretty much one within roughly 10%, 10-15% accuracy. And when you look at the breakdown of the uncertainty, so this, I think, the global mu value, I got it right from the slides, then you see that the theory uncertainty on the signal, on the gluon fusion cross section, is right now of the order of, well, 10-ish%. Okay? Which is pretty much the same order as the statistical uncertainty. So basically, what I'm going to talk about is how can we improve our knowledge of the production cross section. And, well, the number that was used so far in the experiments is already, in principle, pretty high order in perturbation theory. It's next to next leading order. But you know the story. For some reason, the gluon fusion cross-section is kind of plagued by large perturbative corrections. You all know this plot. At the bottom down here, you have the leading order, and then you add the next leading order, you get 100% corrections to it. And when you go to next, you still get something like 50% corrections to the cross section. So you get very large perturbative corrections still at next to next leading order. Which then, of course, motivates to go higher in the perturbative expansion. So what my talk is going to be about is what would be the next number here, a QLO number. And, well, just to set the scene, so that we all agree what we're talking about. So it's gluon fusion, it's a loop-induced process. There's a top quark loop because the gluons do not directly couple to the Higgs. However, since we know by now that the Higgs boson is lighter than the top pair threshold, I can basically shrink this loop. I can integrate out the top and again the effective operator where the gluons couple directly to the Higgs boson. And when I say I'm going to compute in QLO, that's what I'm going to do. So I'm going to work in this theory where I've integrated out the top quark, and it just work with gluons, like quarks, and Higgs bosons. You can, of course, say, well, if you really aim for such high precision, how can you do this crude approximation? I will come back to that in the end, but after this, we know that the top mass corrections at next to next leading order, at least in some approximation. And maybe not a bit small. But I will come back at the end and we'll recombine then QLO computation in the effective theory with all the other effects that we know. Okay? So, how can you do the computation? So, most of the talk will be on the phenomenology behind it, but I will spend 10 minutes also on how it is done. So, how the computation was done is that you go and you say, okay, well, what you actually want to compute in the end is this partonic cross-section, which you then convolute partonic luminosities. And when you look at the luminosity profile at the LHC, then, well, it turns out that there's a very steep fall-off as you go away from threshold. Threshold turns out to be the region where the Z variable that you integrate over is close to unity. And so that means that What that means is that this convolution integral here, basically the convolution of the Pythonic cross section with the Pythonic luminosity, well, it gets dominated by the gluon channel because the gluons are much higher than the quarks, and the main contribution to this convolution integral comes from the region where you're here, where you're close to thresholds. Although you're actually integrating down all the way to tau, which is 10 to the minus 4, but this region is very much suppressed. Okay. And what that means is that you're basically dominated by soft gluon emission. If you're close to thresholds, all the energy is taken up to produce the Higgs boson, and there's not much energy left to produce additional QCD radiation. And what I can do then is I can basically go and I can expand everything into a Taylor series around threshold. So that is what we're going to do.
Could you say back in a standard model, you have this C1 on the previous slide?
Previous slides? Here.
This
yes.
C1? So in a standard model, how big is it?
I would need to check the numerical value. It's known up to NNLO, well, up to NQLO.
But just in that graph.
But it's one at leading order, more or less.
It's not above the numerical value.
Yes, yeah, it's alpha S over 3 pi, yes.
What?
Alpha S over 3 pi.
So that's what I figured.
At leading order.
That's what I would have guessed.
Forgot it has an
so,
alpha S.
Yeah.
It's basically, well, yeah, it's precisely this graph.
So we should keep that in mind. It's a bad order, even if there are these corrections to factor of 2 or 3.
Sorry?
It'll be a bad order.
Well, also this thing gets quantum corrections, they don't. Which you also take into account. Okay, so what I want to do then is I want to approximate everything by Taylor expansion in this region, because that's where the convolution with the luminosity is gets most of its contribution from. Now, I'm going to be very brief on the computation itself. Most of the time we spend on the phenology because I think that's the most interesting part. Nonetheless, I want to spend a few slides on the computation itself because it was the first time that an N3LO computation was done, so you go into uncharted territory. So you also going to face new issues. Yeah? For Hadron Colliders. I'm talking about Hadron Colliders. Of course, I know that for A plus and minus, so is it.
So sigma minus 1 is 1 over 1 minus C. And
that's, I didn't want to go into
there
details,
but
this is the
decorating that too.
This is the, all the plus distributions and delta functions. And then there's the constant term that does not come without any pole, and then all the rest is power suppressed. In. Okay, so here then the outline of the talk. So I said a brief overview of what it means computed in 3LO, and then I go to the phenomenology at N3LO, and it's split into two parts. So the first part will be just about the effective theory at N3LO, and then in the end I come back and I combine it with all the other effects that we know. So, what does it mean to compute at N3LO? Well, let's go step by step. So NLO, you know, you have two contributions, virtuals and reals, that you have to add up. And these diagrams, just so you know what they mean, this is a matrix element times a complex conjugated matrix element. So it is like virtual times Born, and this is the Born, the real emission squared. Okay? And you know the story, they are both divergent, you have that map, you renormalize, and you get a finite number. At next leading order, well, you know that there are three bits, double virtual corrections, and also the one loop squared, the one loop corrections to Higgs plus jets, and the three-level matrix element for Higgs plus two jets. If you go in cube, then you have five contributions, but the counting goes the same way. Three loop corrections to the Born double production process. Two loop corrections here and here to the single emission. One loop corrections to the double emission and a three-level matrix element for Higgs plus three jets. So those are the things that you need to compute. They're all separately divergent, but you add them up and you get to find that number. Hopefully. Now, technically how you do it, well, you generate your Feynman diagrams. It's really done brute force way, you generate Feynman diagrams. You translate them into analytic expressions. So this is more for the experts or the theorists in the room. You reduce everything to a set of master integrals, those are the integrals that you need to compute. You can compute, set up differential equations that these master integrals need to satisfy, and I guess Johannes will tell you more about differential equations next week, so I leave that part of the story for his talk, because that's not related, restricted to Higgs, but it works in all cases. And then I said I want a power series solution, so basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my differential equation, throw in a truncated power series, and fix the coefficients. Of course, I need a boundary condition, and the boundary condition, again, this is a technical point, but for the theorists, this needs it's the limit where z goes to 1, where all the QCD radiation is solved. Those are the integrals that I need to compute in the end. So just as a comparison, what it means to go in 3LO, at NNLO, there were 1,000 diagrams, and in Cubelo, there are 100,000. After reduction at NNLO, it was 27, creates 1,000. Oops, sorry. And the integrals that you actually need to compute in the end, the boundary conditions, there were 5 at NNLO and 72 at NQ. So this gives you a feeling for the increase of, in complexity when you go one or the higher.
So there are a bunch of logs in 1 minus e in addition to the powers in 1 minus e, right?
Yeah. I didn't go into these technicalities, but yeah. They were, when I wrote down the tail expression, actually every coefficient is a polynomial in log 1 minus z up to fifth order. Okay. So now, as
master integrals, 1,028, you compute them one by one by hand.
So the master integrals is they were solutions to the differential equations. So we have the differential equations, and for each of these 1,028, well, we have done it in different ways. So one of the ways it was done was that for each of them, you write down a power series under, throw it into differential equations, fix coefficients. Then there were some other things like single emission diagrams you just can't compute by integrating over the phase space. This we have also done.
You don't do it one by one for this 1028.
You do it in blocks. You have a big system inside. Your differential equations are not 1,000 by 1,000 coupled, but there are blocks in there, also because some are triple real, some are double and virtual, you come in different topologies, so you do topology by topology. It's automated. You don't do it integrated. But you do them in blocks as they are coupled through the differential equations.
So in this sense, they are no longer masters, because what a master is. So do you think, is the block that relates master? Do you have the master integrals that are related?
Yes.
And it's kind of a smaller unit, master topologies, blocks or so, which you have to do by hand.
Topologies, that's the counting is so easy because you have, it's 1,000 topologies in the end, but many of them are reducible. Now, I don't know by heart how many topologies were left. There were things that were coupled where you had master integrals that were not just coupled 2 by 2, where they were 4 by 4, 5 by 5 coupled. Because these systems, so say you get a system that is 50 by 50, there's still some structure in that system. There are, say, bubble integrals, and then come 3-point functions, 4-point functions, and you go higher and higher. Okay, so there's some kind of block triangular structure in each of these systems for every topology. You don't solve the 1,000 by 1,000 in one go. But in the end, this is what you need to compute.
Have you checked the 100,000 Feynman diagrams?
Sorry?
Is there any way you can check that the 100,000 Feynman diagrams
are correct?
It's
a complete set.
Well, so there were various checks. So for example, for the triple emission diagram, where Higgs plus beta the 3-level compared against MedBuff in some phase space points. Then for single emissions, so Higgs plus jet, there are 2 loops and 1 loop squared. Thomas computed the 2-loop matrix element for X plus 1 jet at 2 loops. So the antimatrix element from other sources. We also checked it ourselves. Then there's 6 plus 2 jets at one loop. So there we had, well, we had different independent implementations by different people in the group. Everything was done by multiple people. So that's how it was checked. So some bits and pieces existed already. Then we checked against those. If not, then we just had multiple implementations there.
Did you try to check the linear term in the general excitement?
No, it was done in Feynman gate with ghosts.
It gets quite messy with the rule, but you can take the linear term, you can read only one.
Okay, no, we just had Feynman gate and we had external ghost fields to cancel the linear dependence.
So from the level that you need to do in the reduction, even the linear term would be correct.
Yeah, because you get these additional tensors in the numerator and that kills it. It's mostly a technical thing to get these additional terms in the numerator.
When you say you check the different calculations against each other, do you mean you check numerically at certain phase-based points?
So, for Metcalf, when you check tree-level, that was really some phase-based points. Now, the two-loop, there, Thomas had the matrix elements, and basically we computed the whole thing from two loops in two ways, by using the differential equation as I described, or by just taking the full two-loop matrix element, plug it into the phase space, and doing the phase space integration like you would do in QFT 101. Parameters phase space, and you carry it out, so you just compare after phase space integration. And for those where we had mostly the two-loop emission at one loop, we generated matrix elements in independently due to the reduction independently and you compare the expression to the level of the masters. Okay. So let's go then to the question, well, I do this Taylor expansion, how well does it converge? Because after all I'm after high precision, so how well does my Taylor expansion converge? And you see here what you get after convolution with gluon luminosity, or whatever luminosity it is, so you also see quarks in here. So what you see is that so this is here on the x-axis, you have the order in the Taylor expansion. And what you see is when you add more and more terms, at the beginning there's a wiggle, and then it becomes pretty much flat. So the red one is the one you should look at. The red one is the sum over all channels. You see that there's kind of a conspiracy of quarks and gluons that add up, the quarks contribute negatively. Now, this looks...
Why will you go up to 37? I mean, maybe some special reason, or is
it
just...
No, it was technical because, I mean, you have these big linear systems to solve, mm-hmm. and every time you do it, things get bigger and bigger. So at some point, you decide that it's not worth going higher.
I guess the rational numbers start to get pretty messy, probably by the 37th order.
So,
you can do it all analytically in the rational numbers start to get pretty out of control, probably.
You get huge rational numbers divided by, huge integers divided by huge integers get bigger and bigger. Mathematica just take ages just to load the files, and, you know the thing very well.
So QG, isn't it like always negative? I mean, I remember it was negative at the first correction.
Okay, that would need to check.
Beyond the leading.
Because I would need to check, because I don't know by heart it was negative previous order.
But this is just the three loop piece by itself, right?
This is the NQLO piece. Not just three loop.
It's all terms.
This is the full physical number that would you get by by computing the gluon channel or the quark gluon channel.
Only the third order. But only the third order.
Only the third order, yeah.
Just a question about the glue-glue channel.
Yeah.
The quark-glue channel kind of approaches this asymptotic limit fairly smoothly. You know, you see smaller and smaller jumps as you go from location order 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
Glue one seems to be kind of big jumps in the middle, and then suddenly it stops jumping around a 4. Do you have an understanding?
No. I mean, that's the question, of course, you ask ourselves, what is this? What is this? Because also when you look at the quark-glue one, it is actually precisely the same point where it stabilizes. There's something apparently happening here at this point. Now, we don't have an understanding what that is. Why there is this? Here is dramatic. It is this almost a spike, and then it's flat. What happens at this term in the expansion, Or if there's a deep physical reason why it happens precisely there, I don't know. Okay, so now, if you go and you zoom in, then you see that this line is actually not as horizontal as it seems, but it's rising. But very tight, very little, because it is 2.08 is this point, and this is 2.10. So it's tiny, tiny, tiny. Now, where does it come from? Well, should we worry? Well, when you think of this integral here, so when we compute this thing as a Taylor expansion to 37 terms, around 1, then you know that the full function, this we know, behaves like log to the fifth divided by z. There's a high energy singularity. And you integrate it down to 10 to the minus 4. So what you expect is that things will converge, and actually we check there's no pole in between 0 and 1, and there's no pole in any circle of radius 1 around 1. So you know from complex analysis that this Taylor expansion will converge, but it will converge slowly because of this thing. So how well can we estimate then the convergence? Well, we have to come up with some criterion, and we came up with different ones, so I'm going to give you all of them. One is you just look at the progression of the series from between the last term and term number 27, and you're even going to inflate it by a factor of 10, and you see that the variation is 0.3% or 0.4%. So a tiny variation is you include more and more terms in the Taylor expansion. Another way you can quantify the convergence of the threshold expansion is to say, let's modify QCD factorization. I'm allowed to do that. I could modify QCD factorization this way. I put a Z to the N here, and I compensate for it in the PDFs. I'm allowed to do that. The harmonic cosection is independent. What this will do is, this will change the behavior at Z equals 0. So I can see how much of this singularity at Z equals 0 I put in, I take out, or even might even make this worse, and see how much this affects it. How much does the result depend on what happens at z equals 0? And what you see is this. So this is the value of n, the value of n that you have here. So this changes the behavior at z equals 0. And what you see is that, again, after a couple of terms, things are pretty much the same, and you really have to go and zoom in to see the difference between the different results. So the result does not really depend on it.
But see, the details all depend on exactly how the gluon falls off at large x in the proton.
Yeah. But then, depending on how you set up QCD factorization, you get these small differences at finite orders in the threshold expansion. You see, it is similar. This is the same plot, actually, just with more values of n. And the spread between choosing n equals minus 2 and n equals 2, the already large deformations you want of QCD factorization, is 0.1 picobar.
Wasn't this point that the uncertainties have to do with the gluon structure function?
No, at this point not. This will come later. At this point is simply how much is my approximation of using a Taylor expansion good.
Well, I'm sort of asking what range of gluon X are you sensitive to in this region of the moment? So it's...
You are sensitive to rather small values, and I know it by heart, but you are sensitive to...
I mean, large values of x.
Most sensitive large values of x, yeah. But you go down to 0.8, 0.7. It's not just 0.9. Hmm. You see a bit of tape. That is why you have at the beginning of the wiggle, and then it stabilizes. And it's not just very large values of x that you hope.
I guess
at the higher energy, 13 TeV. So, last check you can make is that we actually, so the cross section is this form, that's what Lance mentioned, that actually also logs, and actually we know everything exactly except for the real constant term. All the rest we know. The only thing that we do not have exactly is F0. I can tell you why, if you're interested in it, it's related to elliptic functions. But you can now say, okay, let's compute everything to 37 terms. If we've done the plot, or we use everything that is in blue exactly, and you see that the difference is 0.004 picobars. So it's a very small result. It really very mildly depends on the inversion of the expansion. Okay, so the conclusion is that the threshold expansion gives a good approximation. So once you've established that, then you can do phenomenology. Before that, you could not do it, because you first have to make sure that the approximation works. And so let's look at how things behave now at M3 LO. In particular, what is the scale variation? And what can you guess what terms we are missing in the perturbative expansion? And, here are the kind of questions that you want to ask. Scale variation, yes. Is there a preferred scale choice? Like, what is root value of a central scale? You can ask questions, those are almost philosophical questions. How well does QCD behave? Especially when you remember the plot with leading order, next leading order, next leading order. There are big jumps, so do we get to a regime where the series looks convergent? And finally, what is the uncertainty that we have to assign to our M3 LO number? Still in the effective theory. We'll comment on Quartmaus effect, electrical corrections at the end. This is all just about effective theory. So let's look at the scale variation. And so this is 13 TeV, PDF for LHC. Here you also see the values of the quark, top quark mass that went in. And what you observe, what you see in the plot is now, it's basically the same plot as in the very beginning, but now also with the N3 LO number. In green, you have the next to next. In red, you have the next, the N cube. And the bands here are the bands that you would get by varying the scale in an interval m Higgs over 4 to m Higgs. So the central value is at 1/2 here, m Higgs over 2. And then you vary in between m Higgs over 4 and m Higgs. And you see that the band has shrunk by a huge amount. Okay, so the green was the scale uncertainty that we had at n, the red is what is the scale uncertainty now, if you vary the scale in this interval. So we chose the central scale, m Higgs over 2. I will comment on that in a second, but what you see is already now is that perturbative corrections are small at that point. And I will comment more on that later. Okay? So this is what you get when you vary the scales. I choose realization scale and factorization scale equal at this point, around m Higgs over 2. I will give you the numbers. It's this, the red band is now of the order of 2%. You can actually go and you can look at, how much of this comes from renormalization scale variation and factorization scale variation. And what you observe is that actually the dependence on the factorization scale is basically a horizontal line. So what you see in this, what you saw in the previous plot was the scale set equal, but it's pretty much the renormalization scale variation that dominates.
Even though the factorization scale dependence of the PDFs is really only
So we only use the three loop splitting function to evolve them, which means that the evolution is correct to n cube LO. We do not have the n4 LO logs, but the result is consistent in n3 LO perturbation theory. So we get all the logs right to n cube LO accuracy. Okay,
I have a tricky question. It's very hard when you got this. If you try to estimate or ask for taking into account the systematics, for example, of the N3 LO on top of the MN LO, you try to estimate before you did your calculation, what would be your estimation? Because this is what will tell me if it was worth kind of spending.
People have done that. People have done this exercise. Some people got, there was a whole variety of predictions. It was like a whole garden.
What was the order of the predictions?
Some of them were completely off, some of them were right. So, I mean, at that point, if I make a prediction without having done the computation, it's like religion. You believe in it or you don't.
True.
And many people did it. Some got it right, but right is not maybe a good word, right? Some, depends on who you ask. Either you got it right or got it lucky. So let's use two words and you can choose which one you want. Others were off. There are also studies made by Higgs cross-section working group, yeah, there's a whole scatter around. Well, you see the exact value and then a whole scatter of values.
What was the maximum that was predicted, not the minimum, the maximum?
The max, so we got here to 48. The maximum was 50 plus, 50 something, I don't know, remember. But it's much higher than what we have.
I guess the simple answer is the previous band at n squared LO contains the new band at n cubed LO.
Yeah.
Pretty well, right? So
yeah, that is also one of the reasons why we prefer the M Higgs over 2 scale. If you choose M Higgs as a central scale, then actually the red one is going to move up, and it sits really at the edge of the NN band. While at N cube, the band is inside, and then we will give you more.
We can talk about the log resummations, because there were NLL predictions before that,
yeah,
which I think were a little
flat. I will.
Some further piece of evidence for those who got it right because they were lucky, is that if you take any of the prescriptions that got it right, use them at a slightly different scale, so MH instead of MH over 2, you will just not get it right. So none of the previous predictions were sufficiently robust that one would say, okay, this is a good procedure, irrespective of what parameters I put in, that gives me a decent estimate.
Can I?
Yeah.
Because if I'm going to paraphrase what you just said,
yeah,
we like this scale because we like this value, and that is not a modulation.
No, wait. We'll, sorry.
Paraphrase what you just said. So, the
sense of the scale. One reason is you see that perturbative corrections at this point are not very large. The other reason is what Davidson pointed out is that you see that the band, the red band, is entirely contained in the green band. So that is what you would expect from the behavior of a convergent series. Then, as Lance said, there were also resummation studies made, and I will also show you these plots. To give you the spoiler, what you observe is if you choose this as a central scale, the resummation at this point is zero, pretty much.
How does the red line extrapolate to mu over mh equals 2?
It goes further down. It goes down quite a bit, but then would you believe the 2M Higgs? It does not change by that much, okay?
Yeah.
The scale, the interval is up a little bit. I would need to check the exact value, but it stays within the percentage range, okay? It does not go to 10%.
So is it within the scale of certainty you quote, 2%, or is it...
The 2. If you go to 2, no, because you see that the red line goes down.
Okay, so you do see some scale dependence here.
Well, you see it here, right? The red line goes down. So if you continue to go to 2 here, you go down. And already here at M Higgs, that's where I go out of the red band at this point. So our scale length is precisely what you get from M Higgs over 4 to M Higgs. And you see that it's going down.
So to push this just a little bit further, if you had thought M Higgs was the right answer because it's times 1, mm-hmm, believe in it. You wouldn't be so far off, then your red band would be on top, at the top edge of the gray band.
The red band would move up, well, the red band would...
Relatively, the gray band would move down.
Yeah. But that's probably the right way to say it. The green one would move down. But
if I see old data and then new data, and the new data is 1 sigma above the old data, I'm happy. I mean, those bands are presumably 1 sigma.
But so the question is, what systematics we should take? Because if you take also the scale variation, mm-hmm, it systematically changes the picture, right?
Yes.
So what is the guidance? What is the right thing to do? Because this is a very important calculation. So what is what do we do?
The guidance is that...
It's religion. Even the scale is a religion, isn't it? If I take MH over 2, if I take...
Yes, but then you see that at some scales, the corrections are smaller. You see that the resummation does not add anything new. You see that the series looks convergent. That's when I would trust that scale choice more.
But you have to be a little careful because if you didn't know N cubed LO, and you see you can make the correction from NLO to NNLO at that point, and you would have gotten it.
Of course. But I'm saying if I see this perturbative correction or this perturbative correction, then I trust this one more. If I also know that the red band is inside the green, I trust it even more. And I will also show you the summation plot, and the conclusion is at this point is basically the summation is zero. So you have lots of hints that this is the right point for the central scale choice.
then it's related also to the average PT of the Higgs, so it's a natural scale. And if you look at higher order correction and the loop in the loop form factors in the vertex, you see that it goes towards the major L2. So there are a lot of theoretical indications that say that the major L2 is a nice scale.
You said that you like
We'll discuss at the end.
Good question. You said you like mu of mh over 2.
Can you speak up a bit?
You said you like the scale equal mh over 2 because the corrections are small.
Yeah.
Why is that the right answer, though?
No, I'm just saying that is one.
I mean, that's a fact, but how do you know that that is the right answer? Maybe mu equals 1 is the right answer, and it's not converging as rapidly as you would like.
True.
I'm just trying to find out what the logic is.
What I'm saying is that I observed that here corrections are small. That is one reason why. And there are others. That alone would not, as Lance pointed out, if I had not, otherwise I could have said, well, at n, I would have chosen this point, which would have been all.
No, I'm asking, so, why is that a criterion at all?
Because you would expect that if the series is convergent, that you add smaller and smaller corrections on top of it, as you go higher and higher.
But for mu equals 1, the corrections are getting smaller.
Well, they're bigger than here. Definitely. And you see that, when, as I said, when you go to here, then the band, the red band, is not going to sit, well, it's barely going to sit inside the green.
I don't quite see the logic of why the corrections being small necessarily is the right answer.
What?
There were two other arguments that point to that scale, too. It's not just that they were small, right? The resummation.
No, yes, the others I will discuss. And then there was the reason to say, an x over 2 is a natural scale because it's the average for here. There are various arguments.
Can I make a non-scale choice comment?
Okay, yeah.
Go on. So you made the comment that, I think also Thomas made the comment, that many of these approximate calculations beforehand either got it wrong or got lucky. Now, all of these approximate methods are making specific statements about what higher order terms beyond n squared LO they are including.
Yeah.
And it would be very useful, I don't know if you're going to do that in this talk, but it would be very useful to go back and see what can be learned about what those approximations said. For example, are they including some logs that just aren't dominant at higher orders? Are they including certain constants that are not dominant? It would be useful to go back and learn from those. So in the future, when we want to go beyond this.
So we have not done that. What I can tell you, for example, is that the Milan group has done a study on that. And I think the conclusion was, but I'm quoting from memory now, okay? So I'm quoting from memory, but the paper was out 2 weeks ago or something like that. That if they turned off, so they were 50 plus. If they turn off the quarks in the evolution of the PDFs and only have gluons, then they go down. Now, what do I get from it? I mean, yes, a posteriori, I observe when I turn off the quarks in the evolution of PDFs, then the value of the cross section goes down and I get it into this region. Would I have guessed that without knowing the full answer?
But they're also making a specific, I mean, talking about them specifically, they're making a specific comment about which of the N3LO logarithms in 1 minus Z they were including. And can one go back after your calculation and say, well, this other piece that was one order beyond what they did is incorrect? Can that kind of statement be made at some point?
This we didn't check. So there you would need to ask them. We didn't check. It's mostly about the 1 over N terms. The logs, of course, are the same. It's the 1 over n corrections, and there we did not go and compare the size of the coefficients of the 1 over n and the 1 over n squared that they have compared to what comes out in the Fresnel expansion.
I'm trying to understand where the quark mass is coming to this.
You will see it. I have a slide where you see the quark, the quark gluon and the gluon separate. So maybe you can go there. So this we will discuss. So let's go to that one. Quark mass is coming here. So when you actually look at the gluons, they go like this, and the quarks go down, and actually it's the interplay between the quarks and the gluons that stabilizes the scale, and also the central value depends on it. I mean, remember the plot with the convergence, we can maybe go back to that plot. You see that if you only have the gluons, you are higher. If you include the quark channel, you go down. And then the effect with turning it on and off in evolution, this we didn't check. The only thing I can say for sure is that if you don't have the quark channel, then you're going to overshoot.
Yeah, I meant the particular values of the quark masses that you showed in the...
Yes.
That's just the PDF.
Well, there's the Wilson coefficient, which depends on the top quark mass. The PDFs are taken from PDF for LHC. But so also the values that I showed, I guess you mean, where was it?
The Wilson coefficient only depends largely
on the top quark mass. Now, what you see here, yeah, that one depends on it. Now, the other parameters you see here, indeed, they not all of them go into this plot, but this is our benchmarking setup that also will be used later on when we add the bottom quark contribution and so on.
Could you remind me? N to N, in going from N3, are you going from two loops to three loops?
Well, so this is in the effective theory, where this is three levels, one loop, two loop, three loops, which in the standard model, full theory, where the top part is present.
It's one more loop.
Yeah. Oops.
In full theory. But
yes.
Here, you're going to three
loops. Here and Q below is three loops in the effective theory.
So doesn't that mean you can predict the L4 log to the fourth and log renormalization logs can be predicted to log fourth and log fifth terms.
Well, so of course we check that what comes out of the computation has correct logs.
You do minimal subtraction.
Yeah. So we check that the logs that come out of the computation agree with the logs that come out of the running of alpha S and of the of
so
the
fourth
of
the and fifth ones are not numerical, they can be done. Well, no, take that back. But you can reliably calculate those.
Yeah, and we check that. We check that the logs of mu r and the logs of mu f that come out of the computation are the ones that you predict.
And now you should be able to go to the next order and estimate.
Well, but then we're back to the question, how much do you trust the extrapolation based on just knowing the logs from resummation and the...
Yeah, well, that's what he's
Exactly, yeah.
Go back and do that.
Yeah. Good. So, yeah, so this inside there's an interplay between quarks and gluons, and you need the quarks to get the correct central value and also to stabilize the scale dependence. So there's a cancellation between the two. One should say at this point that actually none of the approximations that were made, which are all based on the summation, had quarks. Quarks other than those generated by PDF evolution. Because the summation was only for the gluon channel. So this cancellation is definitely not in any of the approximations.
Just a quick question. All the other pure quark channels are completely
negligible. That's why we didn't show it. We have them, of course, but for the plots, they would be somewhere here on the horizontal line, so... Okay. So, just a summary of the scale variation. So now here you see maybe one, I don't know if this answers slightly Eilam's question, so this is the number that comes out when you do the scale variation in this way. I will combine it with the other vectors later, but the upshot is then the scale dependence goes down to the order of 2-ish%. Now, there is, however, an important question, and this brings me now to the summation, is how much do I trust this number as an indicator of whatever I missed in the perturbative expansion? Of course, there are four low terms and five low terms, so how well are these terms captured by these two pretend uncertainties, especially if you keep in mind the fact that at the lower orders, there were these huge jumps. So at the lower order, the scale variation did not capture the perturbative corrections. So how sure can I be that when I say that I have now 2% uncertainty, I actually get something that makes sense? And one way to estimate them, there are various different ways. There's one way that we did, which I'm not going to discuss in detail, is simply by looking at the way you multiply the Wilson coefficient of the effective theory onto the full answer. Depending on how you do it, you generate different higher order terms in the product. And the upshot is, I'm not going to show you the plot, because it's entirely contained in the scale dependence of the answer. And similar things will happen now if you try to estimate your higher order terms in other ways. In particular, what you can go is, and you can now go to the summation, meaning that you can look at the summing leading soft gluon effects. And there are various formalisms for doing that. There is one which is mostly due by these gentlemen here. And the other one, which is more based on soft linear effective theory. So we studied both approaches. One should say that all of these approaches agree to formula QC in the logs. They differ by one over n terms. Okay, so they probe different ways you could estimate the higher order effects.
Where n is the Mellin moment.
N is the Mellin moment.
And where the 1 over n are known or guessed, or effectively guessed differently.
Yes. Depends on what you exponentiate, for example. Do you exponentiate log n, do you exponentiate log 1 plus n, do you exponentiate psi of n? It's all forming the same, but it gives you different predictions. So,
how do these log, can I say, how do these, you know, when you rotate from the Euclidean to the time-like region that you're doing here, you get these I pi factors, right, in addition to the logs?
No, these are not here. These logs simply come from the fact that when you do the cross-section, that in the limit where z goes to 1, when you go to close the threshold, your cross-section, when inserted in your phase space, develops logarithmic dependencies, and those you can predict to all orders.
You can also predict or probably pretend to predict contributions,
may not be... This, they are also, the price was also included in what we did, actually. Yeah. But here, these logs that I'm talking about here in particular are logs in 1 minus z. Those are not IPIs.
Those don't have IPIs.
Or in Mellin space, it would be logs of n. So, what you see here is in green, the next to next, in red, n cube. So the red solid is the fixed order n cube. And then the other lines are effectively different ways of including these logs. So the dashed one here, which is here, that is, if you want, an additional way of doing threshold transformation in Mellin space. So you just have some log n's. And then the other ones are different ways of summing other things, which in the large n limits correspond to log n. And the main message, I think, is that, well, there are two messages. A, they can differ wildly. And the difference is entirely due to these power suppressed terms that you exponentiate. However, if you go and you look at what happens at mx over 2, which is here, then you see that the effect of the summation is entirely negligible. We're talking about 0.00 picobonds. It's really negligible. And moreover, if you take your central scale here and you vary up and down by a factor of 2, you see that all of these are captured by the scale variation. So all of these effects in how we did the summation are captured by the scale variation. Now, this is, of course, the way we did it. Other people do different things, and then they observe this. Okay? However, here there are four ways of doing it. They're all formally equivalent. They all give you the same consistent picture, which is that the scale variation captures these higher order effects predicted by resummation. I should say we did not exponentiate the constants, because I don't see why I would exponentiate the constants.
You said a constant, you mean the delta pi.
The delta. No, well, the delta, first of all. The delta, I could also put it completely in the exponent. The I pi will be in the next slide. Because we also went to soft linear effective theory, and that also includes the summation of these I pi terms. And basically, the picture can be quick here, the picture is the same. So you see, in solid red, the fixed order, the dashed red is the scats, call it scatter resummation. And you see that the dashed line is entirely contained in the band, which is the fixed order scale variation. And just like for the conventional resummation, you see that when you sit at mx over 2, the effect of The scatter information is completely negligible. Yes.
So if I look at the blue dashed line,
the blue dashed line
is NNLO sket, and that pretty much looks like it lies within your N3 LO scale variation band.
Yes.
So this was one of the approximate predictions that occurred before your full calculation.
Yes.
Would you claim that those guys got lucky?
That's, I guess, it's a matter of taste, right? How much would you trust the dashed line?
I don't know. I'm asking. I mean, it's actually meant as an honest question.
Okay, so then we did one check.
Okay.
We said, okay, let's do pi square summation. How much would I have predicted the NQLO constant just by knowing the pi square summation up to n square? And the difference is that you do not even get the sign correct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, then how much would I trust this to predict an N4LO constant term based on pi square summation? I wouldn't, but other people may have different opinions. Okay? Good. So, this basically brings me to the end of what I want to say about the effective theory. So, as I said, there are good indications that m-Higgs over 2 is a good scale choice. The bands of n cubed sits inside an n. The summation at this point is 0. The effects of resummation lie inside the scale variation at n cubed, at least for the most conventional things. If, of course, you can define other schemes, people have done it, you get pretty much whatever you like. That's at least my opinion. And therefore, I think we're in a good shape. We can reliably say that the fixed order scale variation gives us, at least to the best of our knowledge, a good handle on the missing perturbative correction.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So it showed us that the resummation performed in different ways is quite a pattern of shows a pattern of convergence.
Yeah.
But when you were showing the jumps, these jumps are due also to constant terms that are not described by these.
Yes. Yes, of course. But the constant terms also the resummation does not. So.
So what you're checking is that the part that can be resummed is well under control.
So, the statement is that whatever we can predict to higher orders from resummation gives us a consistent picture. Now, of course,
the constant
is what it is. Of course, you can go and exponentiate the constants. You get a constant at N4LO, how much would I trust it? That's then a different story. As I said, I wouldn't, but that is a different story. Here is really you exponentiate what you know you can exponentiate. And you vary a bit what exponential to get a handle on this graph. Okay. So, that was just the effective theory in QBLO, so let's go and combine it with whatever other stuff is out there.
So, Claude, before you go on. So, suppose we take mu to be mH over 2.
Yeah.
What is the shift from the N3LO result compared to the value that was used during NHC run 1, provided by the Higgs section working group?
That is a tricky question because the recommendation was at m-Higgs. The recommendation was at m-Higgs, NNLO plus NNLO. Well, now we are at m-Higgs over 2 and cube fixed order, so...
But you had the plot for the Higgs hunting workshop last year where you drew a line and you show clearly the shift. I seem to remember something like 4% last year. I just wanted to know if this has changed now.
So what is it? I think the previous value was, the recommendation was something like around 44.
The recommendation at m-Higgs, I thought it was known long ago that the mH over 2 was a little scale, right?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Well, they included some resummation, which has some probably lessons, but it might depend on the
shift. So, also when you look at what happens with the resummation, at NNLO plus NLL, it you would be at this point, but then the resummation brings you up. So there you have larger resummation corrections. But I think it was not as clear as this year. Now, as far as I remember, but someone correct me, the previous
calculation was... come from trying to match the
fall off?
Yeah.
So
That's biased toward lower normalization scales, exponential.
Which follow?
The PPER follow up of the.
There's no PPER in here, this is only two questions.
You're saying the earlier estimates of the scale map of what the best normalization scale is, plus that they vaguely remember, they came from trying to match the largest log sum to the exponential.
To be determined. Okay. Maybe just come back to you.
None of these prescriptions have any theoretical
base. Come back to you. As far as I remember, someone correct, I think the previous condition was around 44, correct? 44 picobots, I think. Between 42 and 44, something like that. It goes up. It's an upward shift. But again, you have to be very careful with what you compare, because the 48 now, I'm also going to add electroweak effects, I'm going to quark mass effects. It is an Higgs over 2, no resummation, while the other one was and Higgs with resummation, so it's you have to be very careful with this. In the paper, we actually give the NNL number computed using exactly the same prescription as our NQBALO number. I don't have it in the slides, I also don't remember the number by heart. And I think it was 44. So.
So what root gas was it?
Sorry?
What root gas are you talking?
43.6. 3.6?
43.6 was the recommendation before.
Ah, okay. That was used, the computer using different...
43.6, you said? And now 48?
Yeah.
He's
not done adding other corrections.
Yeah. Okay. The 43.6 was computed differently, so it was closer to my 44. Okay. So, what would be other corrections? So, there could be, of course, two places. I can have other corrections to the partonic part, other corrections to the PDFs. Now, let's start with the partonic part. What could be corrections to the partonic part? There are, of course, two things that come to mind immediately. One is that I had sent the top quark to infinity and decoupled it. And also, I did not include the bottom quark. So, I had to make sure that final quark mass effects are not going to spoil the picture, but rather I want to include the effects of final quark masses, and I also want to include electroweak effects. So those are two things that come to mind when you think about other corrections. And actually, Alessandro already last week or 2 weeks ago, we talked about the bottom quark effects in detail, so here I'm going to be a bit quicker. So what you see in this table now is leading order and next leading order, so not n cube. Why is that? Well, simply because up to next leading order, we know all the quark mass effects. And as you see here is the first line is leading order, next leading order, the effective theory. And then three line, let's jump over the second line. Let's go to line 3, 4, and 5. This line is when I include the exact top mass dependence at leading order, next leading order. And you see that there's a upward shift by roughly 1 picobon. The bottom quark, there's negative interference between the top and the bottom, brings it down. And then I can also add the strong quark if I want. And there's a similar pattern at next leading order. And what people had observed is that when you go and you rescale the leading order result by this ratio, which is the ratio of the leading order exact bond, exact top bond, no bottom, by the leading order in effective theory, then you get pretty close to the exact top mass dependence. You improve it quite a lot. Okay? And so, based on this observation, what we are going to do is, we are also going to rescale the NQBALO number and the NLO number then as well, by the same ratio. So everything will be rescaled by the ratio of the exact top mass dependence by the effective theory. There's one point which I should point out, which is that I told you that scale variation is 1.9% in the effective theory. If you do this and we work in MS bar, then this ratio depends on the top mass, which depends on the realization scale. So it runs as well, so you change the dependence on the scale. That's just a technical aside. It is what it is. And actually it brings it down to 1.6%.
I don't understand.
understand. You've just shown that the B core contribution brings it back down again.
Yes, and I will in the next slide, we will include in certainly estimate for what this thing could be. Of course, that is, right, that could be large, next to next, we just don't know what it is. So we just prefer not to include it, but we therefore include an uncertainty.
Sorry, but you say that.
But these are shifted down, right?
You're not going to include the NLO, TB interference?
Exactly, yeah, because we don't know it.
No, the NLO one, you know, right?
No, this we're going to include the NLO, yes. Yeah. No, so what we're going to do is, everything we know exactly, we're going to include exactly. But then at next to next, we don't know this guy. We don't know the top-bottom interference.
But don't you know on rather general grounds, because you're above BB bar threshold, the TG bar threshold, that you're going to be destructive?
Sorry?
That they're going to interfere destructively. They have opposite sides.
Yes, but does it mean that I can include it? And we will assign an uncertainty to it. So it will be 1% uncertainty on the final number, which comes precisely from this missing effect.
But to make it clear, so the bottom corrections, you are including an
error? Next to leading order, everything is
included. Everything is included.
Yeah, so the next leading order number that goes in is this guy, okay? Next leading order, top plus bottom plus top.
You said the topmost one is at wealth, so you're using the scale U as the scale of the NS bar topmost, and you vary it coherently with the other.
Yeah.
That's not the conservative thing to do.
No, and actually, when you read the last line, there's a strong dependence on the realization scheme, and actually, we also have we include an uncertainty for that as well.
More conservative to choose a separate scale for the topmost. Them independently.
Okay, so here we really chose all the scales equal throughout the computation.
So just to clarify this question, I'm not sure I heard it, but do you want to choose a separate scale of the Wilson coefficient and vary them independently?
I understood that there's a value n top of mu.
So the Wilson coefficient is independent of the top mass through n and the log. So the first time it enters is in cube, so you don't see the logs of mu. However, this guy, of course, the next. This guy and also this guy just have finite fork mass dependence, and if you m is bar, it depends on it. And so, and Martin, I think if you, Mr. Craigie suggested you have a different scale, it would be mu top, which is then m top evaluated as mu top, and then you have, you vary that as well. Is that what you would suggest? Or?
Yeah, the Tom coupling renormalization
scale, yeah. Factorization scale, yeah.
The top mass renormalization scale, in principle, they all.
Okay, so this we have not done. We have put the scales equal. What we did do, I don't discuss it here. It's in the paper. I just mentioned here in this one line is that we did compare on shell as well. Those were the only two variations of the relation scheme that we did. But we did not choose a different scale inside them as well.
In case of charm,
it is even bigger than this? Well, that's even, exactly. So for the bottom, it's 30%. For the charm, it's even bigger.
But you have a number.
It is in the paper, yeah. We looked at in the paper, there's actually a complete breakdown of what the different contributions are in MS bar on shell, and you see how well, for example, you see numbers even for sigma C charm only, or sigma bottom plus charm only. So there's also in the paper. Okay. Now, this was all next reading order. And I said what goes into the final number is the exact thing at next leading order. If you go next to next, well, unfortunately, this is right now beyond our technical capabilities. At least this is also not there. What we do know, however, is the top mass dependence has an expansion in one of M top. Now, this does, of course, not capture everything, but it gives an estimate of what the result should be, and this was computed by these gentlemen, and they quote a number which is plus 1% with an uncertainty of plus minus 1%.
This is after you apply the rescaling trick.
Yes, yeah. This is also obtained by, so you factor out the exact leading order dependence, and then there's one of M top power expansion left over.
You're not a calculation,
sorry?
No.
No, this we have not done. This we took from these gentlemen.
Yeah, yeah. 1% was an acceptance of 1%.
Are they including powers of the Kalakov? I mean, it's not a decoupling limit, so...
No, no, but you assume it's not decoupled, but you assume that you go to the effective theory and you include higher dimensional operators.
Yeah.
This you can do.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah. You can now argue how well does it behave. That is a different story, but you can include these approximations.
Feel
and knowing
about the large Z, the large Z limit is sort of a high energy limit on an effective theory.
Small Z limit is high energy.
Small Z, sorry.
And this is why there's some more in the field.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why there's a large uncertainty.
Yeah, exactly. It's precisely this log Z that you saw. Because if S becomes large, then S is larger than M top, which you assume infinity in the, or very large.
What they do, they remove the wrong singularity at small c, put in the exact VFKL limit there, and then match. So this is how they get.
So, then, come back to Brian's comment, there is, of course, a quark bottom contribution beyond next leading order, which we don't know. So, what we do is we try to estimate it. We did it in MS bar. We also did it on shell. I think that's on the paper. By basically saying, okay, let's look at what is the effect of including the bottom and also the charm at next leading order, and then we rescale it by the corresponding next leading order coefficient. This is what we use as an estimate of the uncertainty coming from the missing top bottom. This is of the order of 1%. Okay, so those are the quark masses. It was quick because that was already known before we did the N3 alone. So also the N3 weak was actually known. And actually N3 weak next leading order is known exactly. However, there is one caveat, which is that this is next leading order electro weak, so let's stay at next leading order, QCD and electro weak. So there's now a next leading order QCD term and there's a next leading order electro weak term. But there are also terms in principle which are mixed. QCD and electroweak. And the issue is that when you think what happens, forget about the electroweak, we know that the next leading order QCD was very large. It was 100% correction. So you might worry about this guy, which gives you QCD corrections to the electroweak part. QCD corrections to next leading order were large. If you want in formulas, you can say, well, in perturbation theory, this expression is the same as this. And then I generate the term alpha S times alpha electro weak, and delta QCD is large. That is the same in perturbation theory. Okay? That's what I just said. Now, this approach here is what people called complete factorization approach, and this increases the cross section by something of the order of 5%. This would be the non-factorization approach. Now, how can we see how good this works? Well, these mixed QCD electro weak terms are unknown, but they were known in some limit. They were computed by Frank and Roger and Barbis in the limit where you assume that the W and the Z are heavier than the Higgs boson. Now, what I can do then is, well, I get a correction to the effective coupling of the Higgs boson to the gluons, which also includes electro weak effects. Of course, you can say, well, that's not good because the Higgs boson is obviously not heavier, well, not lighter than the weak bosons. But you can say, okay, I have the exact next leading order electro weak sitting outside. So this should capture my threshold effects to some extent. And then I add QCD corrections on top of that. That would be the idea. It's an approximation, okay? It's not the real world, but you do what you can. And what you obtain when you do that is also of the order of 5%. So you get a picture that's consistent with the complete factorization approach. That was also 5%. So you get a consistent picture. So that is what we are going to adopt as well. So well, we implemented this, which gives you the same as the complete factorization approach. We also studied what happens when you put, for example, a fudge factor in here and you vary it up and down. you see that you're basically sensitive to it. Nonetheless, including the end uncertainty, I think, of percent level, due to these missing exact QCD3 corrections. But putting a fudge factor, you would pretty much be sensitive.
How do you end up with a percent level?
It was an estimate. It was an estimate based on another way to estimate the uncertainty is to say, okay, so where would this factorization come from? Well, one way where you get this is that you say, we know that the soft limit QCD should factorize. So we made a guess for what next leading order QCD soft contributions should be. We had some criterion what we called when it's soft. And we looked at what is the effect of that on the electroweak, assuming that that is universal because we know that the soft effect should be covered. That's how we got 2%. Okay. So that was all I want to say about the perturbative part. But then that brings me to the last part, which is the PDX. The luminosity. Of course, I'm a perturbative person, so I have much less to say about PDX, however.
So you can be perturbed?
Yeah, you can try. So, nonetheless, well, we can, of course, study the effects of different PDF sets, the PDF uncertainties, this is what we've done. And we should also keep in mind that PDFs have so far only been extracted from next leading order data. So, strictly speaking, while this bit is n cube, this bit is not known to the same accuracy, if you want. So, strictly speaking, when you combine it with the luminosity here, it's not... Not all the terms are known to delegates. There's also an effect that we have to keep in mind that we should, and then certainly we should assess. Okay, for PDF and alpha S, I think the story is clear. So what we did is we followed PDF registry recommendation. So we ran all the different Monte Carlo sets, and then we combined the PDF uncertainty in quadrature with the alpha S uncertainty, where the alpha S uncertainty is just, well, the PDG recommendation, you choose the sample value of 0.118 and you vary it by this factor up and down. We studied, well, as I said, our main PDF set was PDF for LHC. However, we also studied individual sets separately. We also studied ABM, which is not in PDF for LHC, and also HERA PDF, which is not in there. So let's start with PDF for LHC. And what you see here is, well, blue. One, it's normalized to PDF for LHC, and the blue band is the uncertainty band of PDF for LHC. And in the different colors, you see the three sets that were combined to the PDF for LHC set. So CTEC 14, MMHD, and then PDF. In dashed, you see the sample values, and you see they're always very close to PDF for LHC, and the envelopes are also roughly compatible. Okay, so these three sets seem to give you a consistent picture. What is interesting is now you look at the other sets, for example, HERA. Blue is again PDF for LHC, yellow is HERA. And, well, it looks different. However, when you add LHC energies around here, the predictions do not differ by that much. It just comes out, okay? But now the story is a little different for the ABM set. So that is ABM. They are outside the PDF LHC band. One should say is that they also use a different value for alpha S, which they extract from their fit. What you see in green is CTEC with the value of 0.113 that they have in ABM. And you see even then the difference is not explained. It does not just come from alpha S. So green is PDF CTEC with the same value of alpha S as ABM. However, we did not, so there was no other PDF set that provided predictions at 0.113, so we could not do them other than CTEC, and all CTEC did not include the band. So we just have a sample value prediction of CTEC at 0.118.
So I think ABM doesn't use as much data as the other ones.
No, they just use data the next leading order, and they also did the Schoenberg mass difference. No, I don't know the details.
No, but the point in any case is that AVM fit alpha S together with
while the
other groups take alpha S like a fixed range with 0.11 something and don't fit together. The 0.113 that comes from the AVM for alpha S is like the result of a fixed design together.
Right. So I might phrase it in two ways. One, they don't use as much data as the other groups in filling the Parkland distributions. Two, they don't use as much data in filling alpha S, because that 0.118 comes from lots of other data besides Parkland distributions.
I think
the 118 is the world average of the BED, which includes many, many.
Yes, but the point is that this alpha S 118 is, let's say, is plugged in completely independently from the PDF.
But it's that if you choose the same PDF for CTAC, the same value of alpha S for CTAC, you still don't get to this point.
But even the agreement that you see, I mean, from the three PDFs that are included in this PDF for the is somehow accidental. I mean, because the treatment of charm is different from the three PDFs.
Yeah,
so the fact that CT14, MMPDF, and MMHD that are more or less in the same band is also accidental. So
that could be. I'm not claiming that one is better than the other. I'm just stating the fact that it's come out. Yeah.
Well, you can look at the top cross section.
The point was in 2011, we studied in detail this acceptance point and the dependence with the Higgs mass. If you would like to produce a Higgs of 1 TeV, then you would need some more very gluon densities of large X. And AEVM does not include jet data from the Pelotron, so would that provide a completely different description of the gluon density?
In an MNLO PDF you can include only if you have an MNLO computational of digest production. At the moment there is no MNLO computational of digest production, so why is that in the
Okay, I'm trying to describe differences between AEVM and LSS. And that justifier can point out why there is this difference. Mm-hmm. Then we can discuss separately whether you like the way NLO jet data are included or not.
Yes.
Could you repeat what the gray
mass? This difference just comes from the fact that the partonic cross section is proportional to alpha S squared in the lowest order.
This difference, you mean? Yeah. No, but as I said,
it is 118.
This is 118.
What did you use?
This is CTEC.
The orange curve.
The orange is ABM, which the 113.
So what happens
green
if you
one,
put the green at the one? So
green is CTEC with 113.
With 113, but if you put 118,
but then you're here, right?
Okay.
But let's see, it's orange.
Okay.
So you can also see that the CTEC thing, if you put plot and uncertainty around this,
this one, you mean? Yeah, but they don't give this uncertainty. So.
But then you can estimate that from the uncertainty, and then basically agreement.
Well,
this band also has the alpha S uncertainty, which is blocked.
But it's not dominant. So anyway, this purple band around.
This one.
You didn't mention, but. That's the estimate of the people who
did PDFs.
What their error is.
It's the PDF-IFC combination of MMHT, CTAC, and NMPDF.
Some sort of one sigma error on those?
I think this was a 68
confidence.
68%. The PDF-IFC is 100 sets, and the other ones are 68 confidence level. You see that the bands are roughly 6 sets. So it's MMHT is 68 confidence level. PDF-IFC is the 100 set.
And in the next plot, the following one. The
blue band here is the same as the blue bands in the other plot.
It doesn't have the uncertainty due to alpha S.
The blue band here is exactly the same as the blue band here. That's our reference PDF set. It looks different because everything is scaled differently, but the reference set at 1 is the same in all the plots. Okay? So, okay, this is what we just said, so I guess we can skip that. Now, what I already mentioned in words is that we have also taken into account that we do not have PDFs at this point extracted in Cubalo, or from a Cubalo data. So, in principle, there could be an effect due to that. And, well, we can only estimate it by looking at what happens with lower orders. For example, that we can do the next-to-next leading order computation, both with next-to-next leading order PDFs in solid and next leading order PDFs in dashed. And you see that it induces quite a shift. Well, rather here. Okay, this is mhex over 2. And this is the uncertainty band that you would get out of it. Okay, so there is a sizable shift due to the at next to leading order if you use the wrong PDF set.
Can you use those alpha at next to leading order? Or
the alpha is always fixed when in the running of alpha S is in Q. It's just PDFs.
But in the comparison that you saw at the very beginning, when you showed the results of leading order, next to next, and then below, as for PDFs, if you always use the same set.
Yeah, that was the same set.
You also try to do the exercise of using leading order set with leading order.
I think we did internally, but that was probably a long time ago, so I don't remember.
The results were similar, by the way. I mean, the conclusion is
similar. The conclusion is similar. You don't explain 100% shift. Just, So, now, at NN, it is induced as something of the order of 2% uncertainty. Now, how do we transport this all to N cube? Well, basically by taking the 2%, we divide it by 2. So why do we divide it by 2? That is because we do actually know the N cube are coefficient functions from BIS. And when you look at how they behave, then they behave better. Well, the difference between the blue and the red, which is NN, so this n divided by n, and then cube divided by n squared. So the progression of the series in DAS. And, well, for photons, not for Higgs production. And what you see is that the progression of the series is better, gets better. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
And I'm saying that
the
cube divided by n squared is equal to n.
Ah, okay, yeah, you're right. Well, but also n squared divided by n is equal to n.
So they should agree.
Yeah, so therefore, since the progression gets better when you go up in order, we think that this is an overestimate, so we divide it by 2. Okay, so that's it. So now comes then the summary. That is the complete breakdown. Put it all together. If you add up all the effects, then you get 248.58. Now, actually, you do have the number in the plot, Roger. This is the NNLO number, but computed in exactly the same way as our IQ. So it's just the difference is just that you don't need to get it. So if you compare the NN to the NQ, you should compare these two numbers, not the previous recommendation, which was at a different scale and different effects and information turned on.
Well, I think for the experimentalists, what matters is really what is the difference between your value now and the value that they used during NH0 and 1. That's it.
Okay, yeah. So then the answer was 43.6. Still pointed out. So, now this number here, which we call theory uncertainty, is the linear sum of all the effects that we have here. So that includes the scale variation. It includes this the fact that we do not, that we only have a Taylor expansion in cube, the fact that we do not have in cube below PDFs, the fact that we do not know the exact QCD electro recorrections, top bottom interference, and the missing exact top mass dependence. If you add them up linearly, you get this number here. On top of that, of course, you have the uncertainty coming from PDF and alpha S.
Can you comment on the linear addition?
Yes. So,
Prisoner. Sorry? No, prisoner.
Well, we believe it's a very reasonable thing to do. The reason is that this is not a statistical effect. It is not, this number here is not a 68% uncertainty band. But this is, if you want, a step function. This is a box where we say that to the best of our knowledge, you can find the value for the cross section. And it's not the Gaussian distribution, it's some other kind of distribution with some probabilistic meaning. Okay. Also, we cannot exclude, so this is our estimate for the different uncertainties, we cannot exclude that if we compute all of these things, they all go in the same direction. Okay?
So this applies to whether you add in quadrature.
Well, but if they all go in the same direction, they might be correlated, for example.
You're assuming that they're correlated.
Do you ever do conservative estimates of systematic uncertainties? Yeah. And the statistical uncertainties are a lot bigger.
No, but if you add linear, you are assuming a correlation.
Yeah, it's not the same.
Well, but I'm also saying that there is no statistical interpretation in these things.
No, but they get interpreted statistically in the end because there's an uncertainty. That's just, understand that it's not. When you say statistics, you know that you mean Gaussian distribution.
Something like that, yeah.
It's
not that we say that we have a 68% chance that the value is in here.
But when we assign uncertainties on our measurements, we try to give, the error is supposed to represent a certain fraction of the. We're trying to aim at a 68% confidence level. It's not necessarily Gaussian. It can be,
We could change.
You cannot say that if you compute the NLO mass corrections 100 times, that 68 of these calculations will be in this interval.
Of course not. I mean, the sensitivity are experimental systematics, right? It's a guess, and they're not Gaussian distributed either.
Exactly. So, I mean, would you recommend that we treat this as a square potential into which this must sit?
This is the square that we recommend.
Just to make it sure, so because I don't know at the time of recommendations that people were quoting 43.6. So what were the certainties that they were given to the experimentalists?
That one needs to check what exactly of these things went in there.
Yeah.
The actual week was in.
Give us an idea of how accurate.
Not even sure if this was this in. No, this was not in, I think. And the scale is just different now. Truncation, of course, didn't exist. PDFTH didn't exist.
Okay.
This was in, at least in Barnes code, was in. In Barnes, yes. I'm not sure if it was in for Massimiliano for the recommendation.
Which one? You mean? There were two errors associated to it, one called scale and one called PDF. The scale was 7-point-something%.
Yeah, the scale, so that gets replaced by this thing here.
Okay, so 7% and the PDF was.
The PDF is
the same.
So therefore, here we obtain a correction of 10%.
So easy to do this.
From what we were estimating before. No, the 48.50.
No, from there
to there. Compared to the 43.6. So that means that something was.
It is a combination of lots of small effects. You change the central scale, you add on top, then you below is correct.
No, the only thing I'm trying to say is that probably those uncertainties should be considered.
Can I just make a comment? I think you might have said something that confused Carlos there. Yeah. Previously, the scale uncertainty was 7%, but I think also previously the PDF uncertainty estimated a few years ago was on the order of 7%.
Because we said that
you're at 14%, and then these numbers are.
We just PDF. This number, if you computed the old recommendation with PDFs, that's now, that would be the same, right?
I think if you use the PDF LHC recommendation back
then, yes, I agree.
So back then it was quoted large.
Yes.
Okay.
+8.5 -8.4
7.8, whatever. And the total uncertainty was of the order of 10-ish, which was the summary quadrature of 2 seconds.
So Claude, back to the question about N3 or PDFs. I thought there was an argument by the NLPDF group or Stefan Forte that says, or they studied the increase in the cross section due to the matrix element squared, going pretty in order, next reading order, next reading order. They looked at the change in the PDFs and they saw that it's always much smaller when you are going from LO to NLO to NLO. And that's how they concluded that, you know.
Yeah, but also, I know that paper, you refer to the paper that Stefano wrote.
I've seen the talks.
Yeah. Now, in the latest talk, 2 months ago, they actually, now they say that it might even be bigger would be quote. I don't know, they reevaluated their Cacciari-Udu method, so I didn't go through the Cacciari-Udu. And then now they come up with something that was even bigger.
More conservativist.
Yeah, but I agree with Raja that in their first, the paper that they wrote, and also in the talks, they always said, well, the paper was called, do we need NLPDFs? And the short answer was no. And now they seem to have
speculated. But the Higgs, I think Yarn
yeah, of course,
the
Higgs.
Yeah.
So now that we agree that we should have those PDFs, somebody
will Well, I guess it would be nice to have them, but having them or wanting to have them is... different things, because for that you also need theory calculations. For example, say you would need, I don't know, digits, 2 and 3 are low accuracy, okay?
Yeah, I know,
when I say, if you really want to go and, oh, you would need DIS and then 4 low or something like that.
I have a completely different question. The fact that you get 47.02, and Bill was talking of 43 point something, because of the scale,
It is because of the scale and of other little effects. Because there are other things like the top mass effect that was not in the previous recommendation. If you add up lots of little effects, then you get from the old number, which was 43, also the PDFs, that's why they changed this one, you get a different number. That is just, you sum up lots of little effects. We checked that in detail. We checked that. Indeed, I mean, that question comes up every time. Why is your next reading order number not the one that's in the recommendation? We checked it as a sum of little effects. You get half a picobound here, 1 picobound there, and you add them all up, and you get 4 picobounds.
So the 1.56 that you get is a linear sum?
Which 1.56?
PDF plus alpha s.
This is the quadrature sum of PDF and alpha s. This is PDF and alpha s recommendation.
If you also consider this to the other PDFs, I'll be.
We have it in the paper, but I didn't check it. We call it the cross section for ABM, and it's way different from this one.
Okay, so it's not dominant, let's say. I mean, if you really start to consider all the different PDF options, this number become dominant, I mean, even larger than the theory itself.
Well, that is then a question, how do you evaluate this number, and what do you put into the uncertainty for the PDFs? Okay. Right. So just to make it clear, this number was obtained by adding PDF for LHC and alpha as in quadrature following PDF LHC recommendation. This number, which is what you call the theory uncertainty, is the linear sum of these. Okay, so just quick to finish, so the numbers are the same. Where could we improve? We just look at the table of uncertainties and it's easy to see. Of course, there's 1% uncertainty coming from the quark mass effect, so you might want to know top-bottom interference at next leading order. There's the missing QCD electroweak effects, which you may want to know. We already said, and 3 LO PDFs. And the exact top-mass dependence at NLO. So those would be things, if you wanted to improve now, I think, according to me, this would be the place where theories would start. And I think this agrees pretty much with what Alessandro said last week, right? That, for example, top-bottom is by now one of the limited factors if you want to improve the position. Okay, that's all I had to say.